now convene the May 2010 meeting of the Washington State Forest Practices Board. My name is Lenny Young. I serve as Department Supervisor with the Department of Natural Resources, and Commissioner Goldmark, who normally chairs the board, has designated to chair today in his absence. He's off on family business for a few days, and so he will not be here today. I'll be serving in his stead. We do have two other board members who will not be here today. Board Member Sherry Fox is recovering from a serious illness and can't be with us today. And Board Member Carolyn Dobbs is out of the country traveling. So we will have 10 board members present today. And before we go any further, I'd like to ask the rest of the board members and then staff and then people attending the meeting to introduce themselves.
Dave Summers, Snohomish County Council, representing the counties.
Bill Little, board member representing Timber Workers Unions.
Anna Jackson, Director's Designee for Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Good morning, Dave Hagawara, General Public Member.
I am Dave Herrera, General Public Member.
Morning, I'm Tom Davis, Director's Designee from the Department of Agriculture.
Doug Stinson, General Public Member, Small Forest Landowner.
Norm Schott, General Public Member.
Morning, Tom Murray, Ecology.
Darren Kramer, Forest Practices Division Manager.
Phil Ferrester, Assistant Attorney General.
Mark Kingle, Forest Practices Assistant Division Manager.
Shane Martinez, Forest Practices.
Trish Anderson, DNR, Forest Rules Coordinator.
Terry Felix, Forest Practices Division.
Julie Sackett, Forest Practices Assistant Division Manager.
David Whipple, Forest Policy Coordinator, Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Steve Rath, Forest Policy Lead for Ecology.
Tom Robinson, Timber Program Manager, Washington State Association of Counties.
Terry Jackson, Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Mark Dick, Department of Ecology.
Jim Hotbed, Deputy Management Program Administrator.
Gretchen Robinson, Forest Practices Division, Ecology and Forest Protection. Green McDonald, Small Forest Landowner Office, Department of Natural Resources.
Adrian Miller, Washington Forest Protection Association.
Rick Denny, Tree Farmer.
Chris Mendoza, Conservation Caucus.
Connie Brookson, Co-Chair of Blog Smart.
Carol Berta, Blog Smart. Acting Secretary, Stevens County.
Mike Slater, Co-Chair of Blog Smart, Citizens Group in Stevens County.
And we do have a new board member that I expect will be joining us here sometime shortly this morning. Polly Saki is our new board member from Department of Commerce, replacing Brent Barenberg. And we do have plaques that we are hoping to present today to two outgoing board members, one for Brad Avey, who was Tom's predecessor representing Department of Agriculture. And then we do have a plaque for Brent recognizing his service. I think Brad would probably be able to come to a future Forest Practices Board meeting, so we're going to hang on to this and present it to him down the line. Whereas I'm not sure whether Brad's new work will allow him to come back, so my thought was we'd ask Paul to convey the plaque and our appreciation to Brent. We do have one minor change to an earlier version of the agenda. Yesterday, we modified the agenda, and Patricia distributed the new agenda, which moves the report from the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Group into staff reports, and then its place on the earlier agenda is now occupied by a report from the RMAP Policy Subgroup. So that was the agenda that was distributed by email yesterday afternoon. And if you picked an agenda up off the table, then that's the correct agenda as well. But if you have an agenda from several days ago, that's the change that most recently took place. So with that, I'd like to ask staff to provide the safety briefing before we begin the rest of the meeting. Shane?
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Natural Resources Building. In the event of a fire, alarm will sound and flash. Please leave this room using these double doors. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. Please drop to the floor and cover your head as best as possible or go underneath a table. After the shaking has stopped, leave this room using the double doors. In the event of an evacuation, staff will lead you out of the building using those double doors. Then to the first door on your left, circling around the building, moving away towards the grassy area along Jefferson Street. DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to injuries. At this time, I ask you to silence any noise-making devices that you may have. Thank you.
Thanks, Shane. Our first order of business will be approval of minutes from three previous board meetings, and we'll take these with the oldest first minutes from the February 10th, 2010 regular board meeting.
Approval.
I have one clarification to make. So, apologize, I haven't done this before, but page 4, line 4, and I think Patricia has a copy. Just wanted to clarify, let all of you get to that spot. We wanted to add that David Whipple had answered that contact has been made with the current landowner. It's a little bit unclear right now. And add to the very last sentence there on, I think it's line 8 of the same page, and that the department will continue communications with this landowner in an attempt to facilitate contact with any new landowner as soon as possible. So unless anyone has any issues with that, just a clarification.
Okay, would you care to
move with edits?
Okay, so we'll make that change to line 8 on page 4, add that additional language.
Yes, there's two changes, but Patricia has this one, let's see here. Line 6 and line 8.
Okay, good. And second on the revised motion?
Second.
Okay.
I have a change as well.
Okay.
No, right. Okay. Last page is page 16. Just adding a word on line 17. Line 17 says three tiers of protection. It should read three tiers of anti-degradation protection. Just adding a word.
Any concerns with that language change? So the motion is still good to approve with those changes?
Yes.
Okay. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Motion carries unanimously. Now we're on to the minutes of the March 26th Special Forest Practices Board meeting. I have a motion to approve that. Seconded. Any changes needed? Okay. All those in favor of approving the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion carries unanimously. And then on to our third set of minutes from the special board meeting held on April 23rd. Motion to approve.
Motion to approve.
And a second?
Second.
Second. Any changes needed? Any discussion? Okay. All those in favor of adopting the April 23rd minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay.
Mr. Chair? Sure.
Yes.
I was not at that meeting, so I'd like to abstain.
Okay. Noted. And next item on our agenda is a short report from the chair. Just a couple of things I wanted to note on the commissioner's behalf this morning. First, I'd like to note that we were successful in securing the funding that we needed for extending our adaptive management program for another year. We had originally requested $2.5 million in the supplemental budget to keep us going for another year. And we were able to get that amount in place. $1.03 million of that from the Aquatic Lands Enhancement Account, ALEA. $997,000 by increasing our spending authority within the Forest and Fish Support Account. And then another $500,000 from grants that we expect and hope to obtain through the Recreation and Conservation Office. So the combination of those three funding sources fills that $2.5 million gap that we had and will keep us going for another year. So good news there, but we still need to very much bear down on the long-term funding solution, because if we can't get sustainable long-term funding for the program in place, we'll be right back in the same position we found ourselves in last winter very quickly. So we need to take that bull by the horns and work with our stakeholder representatives and staff to make sure we can keep the program going and well-funded for the future. Let's see, the only other thing I wanted to mention is that later today we will be talking about the business reference guide that staff has been working on for us. And we're about to move into public comment as our next agenda item. And we will be strictly adhering, as always, to a 3-minute limit on public comment for each presenter. And also, as you'll hear when we get to the business reference guide, except for the public comment periods and any conversation that participants in the meeting might have with board members during breaks, we're not going to be allowing communication from members of the public to board members during the meeting. So you may see individuals approaching the board during the meeting, but the only people who are going to be doing that are board staff, the people who the board has designated as its staff. And so members of the public are going to be confined to communicating with the board during public comment or during breaks that we have. So with that, we are ready for public comment on general board topics, the topics that we're not taking action on and don't have their own specific comment period. And so the first person who'd like to comment to the board today is Connie Bergstrom. Connie, would you please come up?
I have laryngitis, so I'm going to try to do this. And actually, can you hear me? Yes. Am I supposed to talk?
Yeah, if you could pull that a little bit closer to your voice.
Okay. Is that on? Okay. My name is Connie Bookstrom, and I have been a fireman in Stevens County Fire District 5 for 30 years, an EMT, a retired science teacher. I'm a supervisor of the EMTs for Stevens County Fire District 5 and a co-chair of Lock Smarter. Lock Smarter is a grassroots group representing the local people in our area. It includes retired foresters, loggers, landowners, forest managers, teachers, biologists, hydrologists, beekeepers, you know, just about everybody across the board. The outcry that we have going on over there is in response to huge changes in our local logging practices that are affecting our home values and the tax base and jobs and the future of our community. We're a logging community and we are dependent on logging. We're used to seeing logging. We're used to good stewardship of our forests, and that includes the habitat and the wildlife and the sustainability of logging for future generations. 6 weeks ago, we started some petitions. We have over 700 signatures here. Part of the petition was to put some comments. I'd like to read one to you. It says, my grandparents, this is from John Hardy. My grandparents came to this country in 1900, my dad in 1920. I've been here since 1937. I'm 72 years old. I believe in property rights, but not in property destruction. Excuse me. This is one of the problems that we have over there, is that we're seeing massive destruction. What we have is a huge investment corporation instead of logging companies that own a huge amount of land. And they are stripping the land and making a profit for their, their investors. They're not stewards of the land. We feel like experimental frogs because they're now using a mix of spray before and after that has not been tested on people. The mixture, each one has been tested, but not this mixture. They spray the wildlife also. So the wildlife are losing their habitat and their water and our water is being sprayed. Our hunting industry is hugely impacted by this, the berry picking and recreation in the area is becoming dangerous. Our watersheds are being stripped, and yet we don't have any hydrology studies in the area, so we don't even know for sure what's going to happen to any of the wells and water in the area. They do not have good research in the Eastern Dry for us to show any sustainability in what they're doing. What they have is some research from the wetter coast side here. And what they're doing is making these huge clear cuts, and they're leaving riparian strips, very narrow riparian strips, and those are the only buffers between them, so they're stacking them.
Could I ask you to summarize and conclude where on your time limit?
Hang on a second. Some of the things that the spray is killing are our pea pine that are already 10 years old. And we don't think the sprays are supposed to be killing the native species. We're asking you to consider the difference between the western forests that are wet and our dry land forests, and look at some BMPs that would maybe make a distinction between the size of clear cuts. We understand clear cuts can be necessary. We're not trying to stop that. But the size of them. And look at the spray program that's going on over there right now in areas that are less than 30 inches of rain in the state.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Next person who'd like to comment, Mike Slater.
Excuse me, Connie.
Yeah. Yeah, so
just
a question. Connie, we do have a question for the board member.
I take it this is the, there was a letter and photographs in our packet that you're referring to?
Yes.
Thank you.
And I believe some pictures were also sent.
Right. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Mike Slater. I came over from Stevens County with Connie and Carol. Our family has been operating a small 400-acre timber, small timberland operation for 35 years. I'm a retired teacher. I've worked in the state public education for 28 years, firefighter, EMT in Stevens County. We are kind of like the canaries in the mine shaft. We feel that way a little bit. Our land borders for a half mile, bordered with Forest Capital Partners land. They, in 2008, aerial sprayed with their herbicides and clear cut on our boundary line. They did overspray us. That was an issue that we had with them, and that's been resolved. I want to kind of go over a few things on the herbicide that they used to spray. They have, according to their own statistics, counting this year, they will have sprayed about 57,000 acres in Northeast Washington and clear cut about 17,000 acres by their own statistics. It's a huge amount of land. It's making a huge impact on our local economy, and we feel it's not sustainable. Loggers, foresters, people in the business agree with us. A lot of folks that work for the DNR and the Forest Service really can't speak up because they're in the business, but they're very supportive of our community movement. It's very difficult to go up against a huge investment corporation like Forest Capital Partners. We're just ordinary citizens. But we're not going to be quiet about it. We feel very strongly about our habitat, our watersheds, our hunting areas, and our tourism over there in Eastern Washington. It's a very beautiful area. We're very lucky to live there. We want to keep it pristine as much as we can. This company, for all their good things they do, I guess, has quite a few faults. And we don't want to just point them out and be finger pointing directly at the Forest Capital Partners, because other companies are clear cutting and spraying as well. We just feel that when they're gone and they sell their land, and they moved on back to Boston, where their company is from. They're going to leave us out there in eastern Washington with a moonscape and an economy that will not be supporting of the timber industry. We will lose our jobs. The mills will be closing down like they are in other areas. And we just want to protect the future. So we're asking you just to listen to us and get some information. The herbicide that they're using is a cocktail of three different herbicides: Chopper, Generation 2, Accord, and Oust. It's an defoliant. It's not meant for human consumption or animal consumption. It's not something you might spray on a wheat field or a cornfield. This stuff kills everything. The one concern we have is that it's so powerful that it's killing the ponderosa pine trees that is a climax species in our area. And many of them were planted by Boise Cascade in the 1990s. This defoliant is killing the trees that are already 12 feet high, 15 feet high, that are established. And we don't understand why that is good forestry. It's not. And maybe you can answer that question for
us. Could I ask you to wrap up for past
okay.
time limit?
Okay. So our petition process, we have collected already 700 signatures. And the petition has been signed by environmentalists, by loggers, by foresters, by ordinary people. And this issue crosses all political boundaries. And the whole spectrum of Eastern Washington is represented by that petition process. And we hope that you could listen to us and take a look at changing some rules for the east side of the state. Okay.
Questions from board members?
Yes, and a question. You had mentioned level of harvest, number of acres, and the same for spraying. Over what period of time?
From 2005, this is from Forest Capital's own, their own website. Let me get this right here. They've cut 215 million board feet since 2005. Okay, and that's about 12,000 acres a year. Considering they have 270,000 acres and 1.2 billion board feet, they have estimated in that amount. So that's how we came to our statistics.
And the spraying number?
And the spraying numbers, they estimate about 75 to 80% of their land that they clear cut has been sprayed.
One time?
Pardon me?
One time or multiple times?
Well, this is something we don't know. We don't really aren't sure. Sometimes they have a pre-harvest, and sometimes there's a lot of weeds coming up and a lot of noxious weeds, they may spray again to protect their seedlings. The main thing with the spraying is they want their seedlings to have a good head start, which is true. If you put a seedling out and you don't have any competition, it's going to grow more than if it has some bushes around it. So. But the weeds are competing with their seedlings, so they may have to spray again for that. Just the amount of spray is just not, we just don't want it done, on our forest land, there's too many questions that are just unanswered. We don't know what the final impact of the spray is going to be. That's it.
Thank you. Carol Verba.
Like this all at once. My name is Carol Verba. I'm also a retired teacher, actually a preschool teacher. And one of my concerns, of course, here would be human exposure. We are a very rural area. Families live in the woods, and children go out, teenagers go out, they go places that no one knows they are going. They do things out there. We are very concerned about the issues that Connie and Mike have mentioned. I'm also a member of this Business for a Clean Columbia group, which some of you may know is working with the Environmental Protection Agency now to monitor the results of Cominco's cleanup of Black Sand Beach. So we've got a lot of issues, and I wanted to mention specifically the watershed. As a CCC board member, we're concerned about the flow of water into the Columbia River. Many of the WRIs have not been mapped in Stevens County. So the impact on the watersheds
from this spring, it is really at this time difficult to predict or see what will happen. Hydrologists say that the long-term effect will be for dry wells, shallow wells down in the valleys because they're logging above us. The other concern is, of course, the regrowth. We're a dry land forest. The group that's logging, they're predicting a 50-year cycle, 50 years for the next cutting. If you look on websites, you'll see the forests that will be surviving for that are monocultures, and that's what they are replanting. They're replanting Douglas fir and some tamarack. 50 years till the next cut. That's a long time. That's a couple generations in our area. Many of the logging companies the logging contractors are looking at their sons and realizing they will not be able to do this. Trying to cover things we didn't talk about. Clear cutting is not sustainable in our area. It has not been done there. It's not current practice because of the slow regrowth of the trees. Environmentally, you can remove competition and a plant will grow faster for a while. Rainfall, sun, direct sun, the slope of the hillside, all of those things are factors that are going to affect the long-term effects of this kind of logging in our area. When we first became aware of this issue, it was about a year ago. We tried almost everything, just a group of people who knew that these things were going on. We talked, neighbors talked, we made an appointment with Block Smarter. Block Smarter made a direct contact with Forest Capital just to talk to them. Boise Cascade had been fairly open about communication. They did not meet with us then. We held a community meeting, and that was interesting. They refused to come. And then after that, a meeting was scheduled with them, and they canceled it when we showed up at the door.
Carol, could I ask you to summarize for your time?
So basically, we're feeling very frustrated in the area. We are worried about the future of our community. And looking at the forest practice laws, they do not seem to cover any of this at this point. They are working, anyone who wants to do this kind of logging in our area and possibly in the state has no legal reason not to. If they're meeting the label restrictions on the pesticides, if they are planting the trees at the right time afterwards, if they have the right amount of growth beyond that, they're within the law. And we feel that one size does not fit all, and there's more to a forest than the trees.
Thank you. Questions from board members?
Thank you for your testimony, Carol. Mike had mentioned that you had started a petition.
Yes.
And I was just wondering what the petition is for.
The petition, Northeast Washington is an interesting geographical area in many ways, not only because of the incredible geography of the area, the incredible panorama land, we call it, but the population. We have a very eclectic group of people that live up north there. We go from every end of this, from the spectrum, from the old diehard John Birch Society people to the Love family, and living up there. And when we first were worried about this, we were wondering how widespread was the concern about this logging that we were seeing going on around us. And we decided one of the ways, after our public meeting when people attended, was to just get some signatures and see how many people would stand up and be counted, basically. And that's the intent. Thank you.
Thank you. Rick Dunn.
Morning, members of the board and Chair Young. Thank you for the opportunity. For the record, my name is Rick Dunning. I'm a tree farmer, but I'm also the director of the Washington Farm Forestry Association, and we are a non-profit, education-based association represented by more than 1,000 dues-paying family members. We've been drug into the political, legislative, and policy arena over the last 10 years, and we struggle mightily to participate. I asked Patricia to send you previously two documents. The first was a Family Forest Owners Forest and Fish Promise document that was written by the chair of the Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee, one of our members, as well as another member. And they did that partly out of disappointment with the failure to receive a template called the Conifer Restoration Template, previously the Hardwood Conversion Template, but also just over the fact that the process has seemed to not move us forward to receiving what we felt the promises of Forest and Fish were. The other document was the FREP prioritization, and we're very concerned that DNR is now charged with implementing this. As you might know, we worked closely with DNR policy liaisons during legislation, tried to see a reform of FREP and FOR, which we tried to legislate in the past. We were surprised when, in fact, we thought that was going to move forward, and this prioritization did instead. This prioritization, I'd love to go through all the points of it, but I tell you, this will undermine the very purpose of Forest and Fish for small forest landowners. It will pit Doug Stinson against Sherry Fox, and that is not what the intent of the FREP program was. Instead, I'd like to tell you about our annual meeting we just had. We just brought over 200 family forest landowners and guests up on the peninsula and hosted an annual meeting that was just a wonderful example of what our association stands for. We were hosted by Dave and Annie Robbins, who have the Hama Hama Tree Farm. We had a wonderful oyster feed and saw a great tour. They were the 2008 Outstanding Tree Farm of the Year for the state of Washington, and that is recognized by the National Tree Farm Certification Program, which is the largest certification program across our nation for small forest landowners, and mostly because of the cost. They have a very, very low cost for that, and that is necessary for certification until it could possibly pay for itself. But what I really want to talk about is some of our speakers. Our two keynotes, Brian Boyle, who is past Commissioner of Public Lands, and he's been the director of the facilitator for the Northwest Environmental Forum. He just bluntly said that, in his view, forest practice regulations in the state of Washington are not going to work for small. I could get into all the details that he talked about, but the next keynote speaker was Raleigh Schmitten. And Raleigh, of course, was the first director of Department of Fish and Wildlife for the state of Washington. He then went on to be director of the National Marine Fisheries Program, and he stayed engaged in Forest and Fish, too, and he is a tree farmer, we found out.
Rick, could I ask you to wrap it up for past your time?
Well, okay, I have this passed out. There's 8 points that he spoke of that I think are very, very valid. We believe the same thing. This board will look at them and consider them. But I also want to say that 4 brave souls of the environmental community came forward in a panel presentation in the afternoon for us. And they did their best to answer some very difficult questions about small forest landowners and forests and fish. And I want to thank McGill Perez Gibson for his honest exasperation when he said at the end, "I guess we need a Family Forest Practice Act." And so I just want to leave you with the understanding that forest policy is very difficult for smalls in this state. And we suggest that in your efforts to protect the forest resources of the state, you also understand that those efforts are being undermined by what's going on with the small forest landowners in the state. Thank you.
Doug?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to comment on what Rick said there, and I hope the board can seriously read what he has presented to you there, because small landowners are on a collision course, and I think everybody wants small landowners on the landscape, but the forest and fish isn't working, and if we're trying to get that across to you, but I'm not sure we're getting it across, or I don't know exactly how the board should deal with it. But what I am telling you is there's tremendous frustration by small landowners. Forest and fish is not working, and we're going to have to come up with something different that works for the small, or they're not going to be there. And I am one that put a tree farm together for 60 years, and my goal has always been for this to be in perpetuity. I'm not sure that's an objective anymore. So I'll leave it with you at that.
Chris Mendoza.
Good morning, Board, Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to speak for you this morning. Initially, I was going to talk about compliance monitoring and water typing, but I'd like to talk a little bit about the small force monitoring issues based on what Mr. Dunning provided. Briefly, having conducted some of the small force landowner alternate plans over the years, I'm in agreement with the plight of the small force landowner. I think that a lot has been said and a lot is known about the difference between small forest landowners and large, the biggest probably being that they suffer from an economy of scale. I think that's the easiest thing for folks to get their heads around, is that if you have 100 acres, it's a lot more difficult to swallow 100 plus foot buffers on streams than if you have 10,000 acres. And that, I think, says a lot about smalls. Secondly, I think that, you know, smalls are being asked to provide environmental benefits at that scale for society, a society that elected to forgo those same protections in pursuit of urban development, particularly commercial and residential. So they are unique in regard to what Rick stated earlier, and that they don't have the tools or the land base to respond and survive the challenges of forest practice rules in the way that large companies do. So we support their efforts. Secondly, concerning compliance monitoring, water typing, I want to thank the board, particularly the commissioner who's not here, in providing guidance to his staff, particularly establishing an oversight committee for the compliance monitoring group. As part of that oversight committee, I'd like to say that they're working well as far as providing guidance to DNR on water typing. Most notably that they, most recently that we were, I think folks are in agreement that rather than to kind of look at water typing from compliance and log people that aren't getting it right after the fact, that it would be more effective to address it on the front end. In other words, let's kind of work together to try to ensure that landowners are getting it right before they apply for an FPA as opposed to afterward. I know that DFW and Ecology are both working with DNR and trying to ensure that that happens. And hopefully we'll have some information soon regarding that. Having said that, I'd also like to note that the DNR hydro layer that was crafted from a model is highly variable in its accuracy. It works, can be pretty accurate in some areas and not so accurate in others. And depending on which side of the accuracy fence you're on, that can require a lot of effort to either validate it or not. It can be wrong on both sides concerning whether fish are presence or absence. So the sooner we get that straightened out, and the better. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thanks, Chris. Peter Goldman.
Good morning, Board. Peter Goldman, Washington Forest Law Center. I first have a personal comment, and then I have like to talk about watershed analysis and where that's going. I'd like to thank these three folks from Stephen County for coming here and sharing their story. I've been doing this for 14 years, and you know, we can get buried in the acronyms and the policies and the alphabet soup of what forestry is. But at the end of the day, I think what you heard here are people who live in places who want to see a sustainable long-term forest industry. You know, they're simply not seeing that. We're simply not seeing that in their place. We're simply not seeing what happened in the Tanaway, where a landowner came in and 36,000 acres was logged in Kittitas County within a 10-year period, and now it's up for development. It didn't happen in Southwest Washington, where Weyerhaeuser basically used a 15-year-old watershed analysis and logged steep slopes and didn't even apply forest and fish prescriptions, and led to catastrophic jams. And it's not happening to the small forest landowners, where these folks, as Chris said, are getting buried by large landowner-oriented policies. And they're getting buried, and we're trying to keep them on the land, and there's no money to buy their land or their development rights or whatnot. it's really important for this board to just take account of the, forget the anecdotes about timber industry viability. They don't exist anymore. This board should not be subsidizing this industry. We want this industry to stick around. But this industry has to learn that there are very real costs in these kinds of unsustainable practices. Costs for these folks on the water they drink and whatnot. We want this industry around, but this is not the way to do it. So as we return to all our acronyms and all our studies and all our reports, just remember, 14 years ago, this board was faced with the same question that it's faced with now. Cumulative effects. We have a book, a rule book, you can go forest practice by forest practice, but no one ever looks at the sum total of everything that's going on. That is the greatest shame, tragedy in this forestry business, that everybody does everything piecemeal, one by one by one by one. At the end of the day, the whole watershed's gone. Anyway, watershed analysis. A perfect example. It's been 3 years since the December 07 floods, a lot of which was logged under an old watershed analysis. It's at CEMER, it's at policy right now. While watershed analysis is being reviewed by policy, I urge this board during this report to keep the heat on policy to make sure that this keeps moving. This cannot just simply be permitted to languish in all the important things that policy has to work on. And of course it's important. We're running a research university here. This board needs to make sure that it maintains the rules that do not allow forest practices to escape CEPA review, that require CEPA review under today's rules. This board needs to keep a tight rope on this. So I urge during the policy, during the discussion today on the status of watershed analysis, I urge this board to maintain a really tight rope on what's going on in policy. It simply cannot be permitted to languish there. This board needs to bring its rules up to date. We don't have funding for watershed analysis. We don't have substantial landowner commitment to do watershed analysis, with a few exceptions. It's time to fix that loophole. That's the very least this board can do with watershed analysis. And then this fall, we have a lot of work. Yeah. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Miguel Perez Gibson.
Miguel Perez Gibson on behalf of the Conservation Caucus. Just want to speak about three things real quickly. Small forest landowners, human effects, and the need for more money in these programs. I'm not going to repeat a lot of what you heard from earlier, but the long-term viability of the timber industry and the sustainability of natural resources. I don't know if you can do that one forest practice at a time. I think that the issue of cumulative effects needs to be addressed by the board sooner or later, and in the Maury Island decision with Glacier Northwest, that was one of the key issues that was in that case where the judge decided a death by a thousand cuts is what was happening in Puget Sound, and I think you can hear it in the voices of others in the communities where timber mining may be operating. That's number one. Number two, on forests, small forest landowners, I just want to say on some specifics on the BREP program. We really should have a target that gets to about $4 million. And the Small Forest Landowner Office really does need to be funded at a level which allows it to do what it needs to do. I know that the smalls and the bigs don't like to speak against each other, so I'm going to be in the uncomfortable position, I think, of just pointing out that I understand how we need to take care of the larger landowners, but I don't think we should be subsidizing them at the cost of the smalls. We heard about the 72,000 acres of clear cut. Well, that was done at $50 a whack permits. And that $50 a whack permit, 100 acres is as much as $250,000 net in some of these logging operations for $50. Cost of DNR, what, $5,000 to process one of those permits? I think we could raise a little bit of money, change the law, have it circle back into a fund that supports the small forest landowners. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the room who did not sign up to testify on general matters who'd like to provide comment to the board at this time? Jeffrey?
Good morning. Jeffrey Thomas. I'm co-chair of the Timber Fish and Wildlife Cultural Committee and otherwise director of the Timber Fish and Wildlife Program for the Gulf. Just a brief comment on WAC 222-20-120, the notification of forest practices to affect Indian tribes. I won't have a chance to talk about that later on this afternoon, but just did want to say that the Gulf tribe is in support of revisiting the rule language and possibly seeing some modifications. And so with that, I'm sure you'll be hearing a little bit more about that later when I present the committee's work. Thank you.
Bye. Is there anyone else who'd like to provide a comment to the board on general matters? Okay, if not, we're going to move into a series of short staff reports. We have 7 staff reports and 15 minutes allotted on the agenda, so we need to keep these to about 2 minutes apiece. First staff report, Jim Hotbed, Adaptive Management.
Good morning. There are three fairly new members, one very new member. I'm the Adaptive Management Program Administrator. My position was created by the board, and I'm the liaison between the board and two other committees that the Forest Practice Board created, which are SEMR, the science side, and then policy on that side. What I sent you for the staff report was something called the Project Functions Table. Every year when SEMR develops its annual work plan, it evolves and improves the work plan. One of the things I worked on this year, which is new, is the Project Functions Table. What it includes is 95 projects, including the status of those projects. But more importantly, what it shows is it shows the forest and fish goals in terms of fish, amphibians, and clean water, as well as riparian functions associated with each of the projects. So there's a number of questions that you could ask. For example, which of the functions does a particular project address? Or are there any gaps in terms of, do we have functions or goals that are not being addressed by projects? So it's a fairly useful table. And I applaud SEMR for working on it because it was an effort.
Okay, thanks. Questions for Jim? Next staff report on the board manual, Mark Engel.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the board. I'm going to do a combined report for both the board manual and rulemaking. They're back-to-back in your handouts. And basically, I'll just start with the rulemaking. The riparian open space rulemaking is progressing. We do plan on presenting the 30-day review to the board at the August meeting. We also want to bring this rulemaking in sync where we'll be developing the board manual at the same time that we're developing the rulemaking so that when the board considers adoption of the rule, they will also consider approving the board manual. The Northern Spotted Owl rulemaking, today the board will be asked to adopt the permanent rulemaking for Northern Spotted Owl. Administrative appeals is also on the agenda today for a 30-day review of expedited rulemaking. This is a result of legislation during this past session. We're also today going to ask for the board to provide notice to the public of the board's intent to revise language for cultural resources rulemaking, which was what Jeffrey just testified to in 222-21-20. That will also be on today. On the work plan for the board, we will modify this slightly for the August meeting. Under the annual reports, we actually have a semi-annual report, and that is for compliance monitoring, and this year is the year for that report, and we plan to bring that before the board at its November meeting. And then for the upland wildlife, that is actually the upland wildlife work plan. And for the completion status, we're going to change that to ongoing. So with that, are there any questions?
Okay. Thanks, Mark. Next, compliance monitoring, Walt Obermeyer.
Good morning, board members. I'm Walt Obermeyer. This morning I'm providing just a brief update on my written report last month. Currently the program sampling is now at 46% complete for this year statewide. We've got a good start on it this year, and hopefully fire season will not get in the way of that. Olympic region is complete, and so are northwest and northeast, except for some high elevation stands. We're using a little smaller sample size this year without an emphasis sample on a specific activity. That gives us time to develop things like the haul route process for this next year in accordance with the Clean Water Assurance milestones, develop a program to look at haul route compliance specifically. So we're looking at an approach that develops a different sample so that we catch the haul routes while they're being hauled on. And that's a kind of major change in our sampling strategy that should provide some decent results. And we're also looking at the dispute resolution process for the clean water milestones and the riparian non-compliance. Now, we're still on track for doing the sample analysis and getting that presented this off for the last weighing. Any questions?
Walt, in your report in the section Compliance Monitoring Stakeholder Committee,
yes.
There's the third bullet, an agreement that rule compliance will be the primary emphasis of reporting rather than application compliance. Could you elaborate on that just a little bit, please?
Yes, we've had some discussions. Sometimes an application can be in compliance with the rules, but not in compliance with the application. And that has to do where they meet all, say in a certain riparian zone, they may have said that they are going to leave a buffer strip such and such a width that is maybe larger than that required. Well, they might not have left that entire buffer strip as they prescribed on the application, but yet it does meet the rule requirements. And we just wanted to make sure that what we're reporting is as an efficient force official reports, since it's compliance with the rules, and try and separate that. We will still have information about compliance with applications, but the primary thing we're going to look at is it meeting the intent and the letter of the rules.
Thank you.
Walt, that next bullet down on haul route review, can you expand on that a little bit?
Yes, that much of that has been triggered by the Clean Water Assurance milestone to look at certain rule elements within the compliance monitoring program, and prescribes a way to analyze the compliance of the haul routes. Currently, when we do our sampling, we look at the application area. We don't look at the haul route between the application and the public access. And so this is an activity or an emphasis that's directed at looking at how are those roles holding up, are they in compliance with the standards and the rules required. So that's what this is. And we want to do that during the period of haul so that we don't look at, you know, what might happen after the haul was over from non-enforcement activities. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you. Mayor McDonald, Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee and the Small Forest Landowner Office.
Good morning, board members and Mr. Chair. There should be an update of the Small Forest Landowner Office and the Advisory Committee in your packet. Just to go briefly over each of those subtopics. On March 9th, the Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee decided to suspend all work on the conifer restoration template The landowner caucus of the committee believed that the template being developed would not be supported by the broader community of their small forest landowners. Forest riparian easement program, we just recently got a proviso with the supplemental budget of what we may have up to $1 million. We're trying to figure out how to implement the prioritization and that proviso language. So the prep budget for the upcoming year is probably going to be close to $1.1 million. Forestry stewardship program, we're looking at in the near future. We anticipate having one West Side stewardship forester coming on. The funding has been coupled from WSU Extension and some federal money to support that person. On the Family Forest Fish Passage Program, we recently acquired two grants that's close to $52,000 to support removing fish barriers from federal funding. And then long-term applications, even though there hasn't been a lot of field or landowner assistance out there, we are still getting a couple of applications on the long-term application. As you can see, there's 45 that have been approved or in some sort. Is there any questions?
Greg Dunning earlier in his public comment indicated a potential problem in the prioritization of FREP expenditures. And the last sentence, it looks like in your report here in, under that area, indicates an interest in working with stakeholders to try to come up with some solution to that. Am I reading that correctly? In that
there's the how we're trying to figure out the proviso language. And what we're looking at now is that the legislature gave us like 14 elements to implement as far as with the money that was allocated. It also gave us the direction for future funding to reach out to stakeholders. So that would be like changing and coming up with legislative language by October. So two separate elements, one to implement the proviso language, and then a second element that would be to bring in stakeholders to collaborate on final recommendations to the legislature by October. Is that?
Okay, thanks, Mayor. DFW Cultural Resources Committee, Jeffrey Thomas and Peter Heidi.
Thank you, Board Chair and members of the board. My name is Peter Heidi. I'm the Director of Policy for Forest Policy for the Washington Forest Protection Association and co-chair of DFW Cultural Resources Committee.
Yes, I'm Jeffrey Thomas, again, Director of the Timber Fish and Wildlife Program for the Gallup Pride and co-chair for the Cultural Resources Committee.
Each regular meeting, we provide you with a copy of our, updated copy of our action plan, and that essentially is our report. But I'd just like to, Jeffrey and I, would like to point out a couple items on the plan this time. First of all, I want to thank Darren Kramer and Rodney Foster. We met with these two DNR employees and talked about the proper place for the PFW Cultural Committee within the structure of Forest Practice Board, and we're waiting for their response to our discussion, but we're very happy that they were able to meet with them. A second point I'd like to mention is that we did complete a brainstorming session for preparing what we think will, one of our tasks is to prepare guidance documents for cultural resources, and I want to remind the board that this isn't going to happen very fast because of our staffing situation, which essentially is zero, but we're all working best we can at this, and you can expect sometime in the future to see some of these documents come out of our committee. And I'll just let Jeffrey point out a couple other items.
Thank you. As you'll see on the list, the official standing of the Cultural Resources Committee has been an especially important topic for the committee, and so we were happy to talk about that with Darren and Rodney. I do look forward to continued progress there. the cultural resources guidance document workshop. That was very, very helpful. We do have some lists and quite a few target items that we hope to be working on during the year. The use of the GLO information, item three, has come up recently as a very important topic in the Puyallup watershed area, so I just want to flag that for you. It may be getting more attention soon. And revisions to WAP 222-2120, as I mentioned earlier, that is viewed as especially important work by the committee. It is something we're putting a priority on, even at our next meeting, and continue to look forward to the efforts of the board during 2010 on this topic as well. I would say that that's really pretty much the wrap-up. We have had a very busy quarter and look forward to another busy quarter in the midst of one now, and really expect that our 2010 work schedule to be really important and meaningful overall. Any questions?
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And our last staff report on the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Group, David Whipple.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. David Whipple, Forest Policy Coordinator, Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'll try to be very brief. There's about a 1.5-page summary from Chuck Turley of DNR, who couldn't be here today, so I'm speaking on behalf of him. He is the chair of the Spotted Owl Implementation Working Group, which you formed at your February 10th board meeting. The Implementation Working Group was asked to do a number of things, including developing a prioritized work plan to implement the consensus recommendations of the previous Spotted Owl Working Group, to coordinate with federal agencies relative to barred owl control experiments, and also to convene a technical team relative to assessing and directing allocation of conservation efforts for the Northern Spotted Owl and non-federal lands. The implementation working group was able to meet just once due to a longer legislative session than was anticipated, and also some scheduling issues and getting membership confirmed on that particular working group. As you'll see at the bottom of the memo, the members of the implementation working group are Sean Cantrell, Kevin Godbu, Bettina Von Hagen, Chuck Turley, and myself. And relative to the deliverables that that were due to you folks today, the group, among many other things, we discussed and adopted a set of ground rules. Those are the ground rules that the previous working group had adopted and abided by. And we also began drafting a charter that is largely going to be reflective of the previous working group as well, because that the members on the implementation group felt that that was a very good charter. And finally, as far as deliverables for today, we discussed the issue of facilitation and whether or not we needed facilitation, and that was determined by the entire group on a consensus basis that we did not need facilitation at this time. And I would just add that Chuck Turley has had some conversations with and Bird of Fish and Wildlife Service relative to barred owl control experiments. And just kind of a side note, that I thought the meeting, we had about a 4 or 5 hour meeting, I think, one day, and I thought it was very productive. We discussed a number of things other than the nuts and bolts that we were to deliver on, but more in terms of incentives and how we achieve some conservation benefits for Northern Spotted Owl. And I think it's been a big addition to the group to have the land trust representative there. So with that, answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
That concludes staff reports, and we'll move along to our next agenda item, legislative update. Darren Craig.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Darren Kramer, Forest Practices Division Manager. In your packet, you have a couple of two-page sheet summarizing the legislative activity from the last session and the effect to the Forest Practices Program. We looked at, analyzed over 80 bills this last session, even though it was a short session, so it was a pretty busy one. We ultimately had 6 bills that affect our program, 2 directly and 4 indirectly. So walking through the first one, 2541, many of these you've heard of before, so so I'm going to cover the highlights, and if you have questions, we can go over those at the end. 2541 is the incentives bill, an act relating to maximizing the ecosystem services provided by forestry through the promotion of incentives. It has a number of elements. This does not involve rulemaking, but does amend the Act, the Forest Practices Act. And the program will be participating in producing a report that outlines incentives to meet the intent of the law, and then presenting that to the legislature, the governor, the board, the commissioner, a variety of other folks by December 2011. That law takes effect in June. The next one, 2935, this is the one you've heard about already and we'll hear more about later today. This is the act and RIC related to environmental land use hearing boards. It basically eliminates several environmental appeals boards, consolidates them. The Forest Practices Appeals Board goes away effective July 1. And future forest practices appeal from that date forward will be heard by the Pollutions Control Hearing Board. There's a variety of other provisions to the bill related to date of receipt, timelines for notice, that sort of thing. But the main effect to us is we have to do rulemaking to note that the Pollutions Control Hearing Board is going to be the appeals board for forest practices appeals in the future. The Forest Practices Appeals Board will remain until all appeals up to July 1 are complete. At the bottom of that page is 2420, an act relating to promotion of industries that rely on the state's working land base. This is a no direct effect bill that may require us to take this into consideration when we are conducting environmental or economic analysis for future rulemakings. 6481, another no direct effect bill, clarifies which local governments have jurisdiction over conversion-related forest practices. This basically implements a population divider between LG local government entities that take over conversions. If a local government entity has a population of 100,000 or more, they are to take over jurisdiction. If less, they have discretion not to. So that's the main change. And it also removes the due date, the 12/31/08 due date, which was the original time frame when local government entities were supposed to assume jurisdiction, has been removed. No rulemaking, but that law becomes effective in June, and we'll simply be working with local government entities and notifying them, making sure they're aware of that change. 2617, this is another boards and commissions bills relating to eliminating boards and commissions. This is a indirect effect bill effective in June. No rulemaking required, but certainly has an effect on the program. Class 1 boards, which includes the Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee, all funding support for travel, etc., were removed from Class 1 boards. So that does affect the Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee. We'll need to make better use of teleconferencing and state facilities for those meetings in the future. We are to implement cost-saving measures for Class 4 boards, which includes the Forest Practices Board. The AG's office is working on an advice memo on this on how best to implement it. There's lots of detail in the language. So at this time, we don't know exactly how we're going to do it, but in the future, for the next year, starting in July, we have to implement cost-saving measures for the Forest Practices Board. So more to come on that. And finally, 6578, an act related to creating an optional multi-agency permitting team. We think this is probably a low-effect bill on us. It becomes effective in June, but basically pulls together senior permitting personnel from regulatory and environmental regulatory agencies to work with the Office of Regulatory Affairs to try to streamline permitting for large projects. There may be some projects in the future that involve harvest, so DNR is mentioned in the bill as a possible participant. And that's it. Questions?
Darren, in the very first one you talked about, 2541.
Yes.
The second point in the first paragraph there talks about consultation with Forest Practices Board. I know the rule isn't even in effect yet, but is there
a plan underway in which that consultation may be developed. Any particular thoughts at this point on how the board will be involved in the...
Yeah, I don't have any detail for you, but certainly we will be consulting with the board along the way. It's directed right in the law. Our policy shop in the department is in the lead on this, not the program. So while we're going to be working with them, they're in the lead on this this issue. So I don't have any detail for you, but I'm sure there'll be more to come at future board meetings.
Okay, I would appreciate updates on that as this moves along. Thank you.
Any other questions for Darren on laws passed this session? Okay, if not, Darren, thank you.
Thank you.
And we're scheduled for a break. We'll reconvene right at 10:25, 15 minutes from now, 10:25.